We're doing Pirkei Avot. We're up to what's called the fifth chapter, the 19th Mishnah. We'll read the Mishnah, we'll try to understand the Mishnah, and then we'll try to analyze how you apply it in the home. The Mishnah says, Kol mi sheyesh bo shlosha dvarim alalu, whoever has the following three things, mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu, then he is considered a disciple of Abraham, our patriarch. V'shlosha dvarim acherim, and if he has three other things, mitalmidav shel Bilam harasha, then he is considered a disciple of Bilam the wicked. You guys remember who was Bilam? That's a quick recap. The Jews were holding just before they were entering the land of Israel. It was their final year in the desert. After 40 years of traveling, the Moabites hired Bilam the sorcerer to come and curse us. And whenever he tried to curse us, he would end up blessing us. In the process of making their attempts to hire him, Bilam kept trying, and God said no. And then Bilam wouldn't tell them, God told me not to go. Bilam would say, God doesn't let me go with guys like you. If the king wants me, he has to send more respectable officers. And then when he comes, he tells the king, you know, you really should give me all your wealth for the services I give you. And whatever they offer him, he always wants more. And he can't even deliver, because anytime he tries to curse us, instead what comes out are blessings. And finally, the Moabite king is fed up with him and he sends him home. And Bilam says, before I go, let me give you a piece of advice. And he begins by giving him painful advice. He tells him, you should know these Jews, they're going to conquer the world. I wish I were one of them. But then when God lets go of him, so to speak, and lets him talk his peace, he says to Balak, the Moabite king, he says, if you want to take them down, you hire as many prostitutes as you can, send them down there, and you'll find that that's the way to bring them down. Just tempt them. And they do that, and 24,000 Jews die. Because Jews go off to these women, they find ways to seduce them, and then God sends a plague, 24,000 Jews die, and Bilam comes back. He goes to the Moabite king and says, pay me, look, my advice worked. And as he's coming back to collect on his advice, God sends the Jews to wage war against the Moabites for what they've done to cause us to sin. And in the process, Pinchas goes, Pinchas is the Kohen who was sent to lead us out to war, and Pinchas kills Bilam in the process of the war. There's an interesting medrash that Rashi over here quotes, Rashi on this Mishnah, that on Bilam's grave, it was engraved on his tombstone, here lies Bilam, who died at the young age of 33, He was killed at the age of 33 by Pinchas, the armed bandit. That's how they call Pinchas. Pinchas the thief. So Bilam dies a young man, according to that, right? So we're going to compare in this Mishnah, the Mishnah is going to contrast the traits of Abraham with the traits of Bilam. So the Mishnah says as follows. If one has the following three attributes, then he is a disciple of Avram. Number one, Ayin Tova, a good eye. When he sees other people prospering, he sees it with a good eye. That's called an Ayin Tova. He's happy with others' success. He looks positively at others' success. And Ruach Nimucha, a humble spirit. V'nefesh shefeila, and here this is also a type of humility. The idea here is that he talks to people as his equals. He doesn't put himself above other people. That's another type of humility. So if he has these three qualities, so then he is a disciple mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu. He's a disciple of Abraham. But if he has the other three qualities, ayin ra'ah, he has an evil eye. He's jealous when others prosper. He always wants more. Veruach gevoha, and he's arrogant. Venefesh rechava, and he's always seeking more wealth. He is, what would you call that in English? What's the word for that?
Greedy.
Greedy, miserly. his so that's a disciple of Mitanmidav shel Bilam Arasha. He's a disciple of Bilam the Wicked. Ma ben Tanmidav shel Avraham Avinu Tanmidav shel Bilam Arasha. What's the difference between the two? Tanmidav shel Avraham Avinu Ochlin Ba'olam Hazeh V'Ochlin La'olam Haba. Disciples of Abraham, they benefit in this world and in the world to come. Shneimar, the verse says, La'anchilo Ava Yesh V'Tzoteim Amalei. The Torah says, I grant those who love me, I grant them continued existence, and in this world their storage houses will be full. Aval Tanmidav shel Bilam Arasha, Yoreshin Genom Yoredim Neber Shachat. The disciples of Bilam the Wicked, they end up in perdition, they end up in the grave, as the verse says. The verse describes, David says, the people who are slandering me, the people who are always jealous of me, God, you sent them to the grave, they didn't even live out half their lives. And that's the key, that Bilam doesn't live till 35, right? We say the average life is 70, and Bilam dies at the age of 33. So that's the verse about the disciples of Bilam. Yeah.
First of
all, wasn't the advice of Paro also? So that's
an age.
Right? No, it's not possible. The two Midrashim conflict, because the advice that Paro was given to throw the babies into the Nile was 120 years earlier. So if he was giving Pharaoh counsel back then that Midrash does not agree that he died at age 33. Two conflicting Midrashim, right?
First part of it about what happens in the next world, no problem. We have no evidence that that isn't so. And you could even make a case that someone who really is arrogant and, you know, overcome with jealousy can't have any peace in this world. The problem comes into the first part. The person who looks with a good eye, decent people who don't necessarily prosper in this world.
So let's see. Let's go one step at a time. Okay. Yes.
I missed the kesher between the disciples of Bilam and, you know, and basing on their, you know, the traits of greediness, not having a good eye, and living out half their lives.
It says that that's a punishment. That's what happens. People think if they'll be greedy, if they'll be jealous. It's really quoting a pasuk, but that's how the Mishnah is applying it.
Maybe he's dead while he's alive or something.
Let's see. Let's go one step at a time. Okay, so what's a good eye? Rashi says two things. Rashi says he's not jealous of his friend, and his friend's honor is as cherished as his own. Now, those two are very hard. Not to be jealous of a friend, it's very hard. Human nature is that we want things, and we want them more when we see someone else has them. If we work on it, if we work to develop, to look positively at someone, we can get there. There are different approaches how to get there. One approach is to feel connected to someone. There's an Italian saying, the Italian and the mafia, they always say, employ your own blood so that when you steal from one another, it all stays in the family. We don't say that, but if it's your own family member, then you could be at peace with it. Very often, the reason we're jealous is because we see someone as different. They're not a part of me. The more I see them as different, the more I can be jealous of them. If they're an extension of myself, I'm not going to be jealous of them. Proof of the matter is that when it's one's own son or one's own disciple, so then a normal relationship with a child is that you want them to do better than yourself. A normal parent tells his child, I'm your minimum, you should do better than me. A normal parent is not threatened when his son becomes more observant, more successful, more educated. If he's moving up in the ladder, be it in ethics, be it in religion, be it in finance, I should be happy for him. A normal parent is not jealous of that. We say, Bakol Adam Mitkane. Nature, human nature, allows us to be jealous of anyone except for one's own children and one's students. Now, that means that the more I feel connected to someone else, the less jealous I'm going to be. I can see positively. Maybe this goes in line with the idea that the whole world felt connected to Abraham. It says that after Abraham saved the Sodomites, he fought the battle to save the four kings, including the Sodomites. So then the whole world united and declared Abraham as head of the UN. They said, we're forming a world council, and we all want Avram to be the head. So that means our sages say, initially he was known as Avram, which was a nickname. Av le'Aram. The Arameans called him Avram, which was a way of saying, we view you as our father. Avram. Av le'Aram. And then, not only God changed Avram's name to Avraham, but the world viewed him as Av Hamon Goyim, father to all the nations. So all the nations looked up to him as a fatherly figure. Avram can pray on behalf of the Sodomites. They're terrible people, but Avram can pray on their behalf. So when we look at marriage, we like to think that we wouldn't be jealous. I'd only want my wife to succeed. And what if she has a PhD and you don't? And what if she's making 100 grand and you're making 50? It's not easy. So there's the key to looking positively is feeling connected. If we're one, so then success is our success. We would like to think that once we get married, it's second nature to view the other as a part of ourselves. No, it isn't. It takes years of work. You fake it, and eventually it becomes true. But it takes years of practice.
Why is this the case?
Because it doesn't happen overnight.
You said that. I understand the fact that it doesn't happen overnight. I'm asking why not. If it's understood that, we're married now and we believe, as we do, that our union is one and we're a team together. And we have, our mutual goal of whatever we decided it was before we got married. Now that we're married, why is there not what causes it? What causes there to be any sort of separation? You're united. You're the team. It's a two-person team, and there you go.
That's great. But what happens when there's one guy who always strikes out on the team? And we're all a team. But he's the goalie that lets the goals go in. So you say, let me get a better goalie. It's very nice. You get married and suddenly you discover that she always breaks eggs. She always forgets to check the eggs before she buys them. So on every tray of eggs that you buy, you lose 5 shekels. So you say, it's not a big deal, right? It's not a big deal. But then she buys milk and she forgets to check the date and it's sour. And you tell yourself, it's not a big deal. It's really not a big deal. I know I wanted cereal this morning, but it's not a big deal. We're a team. And then she puts the toast in the toaster and she forgets to take it out. And you're telling yourself, it's not a big deal. I'm going to go to work without breakfast, but it's not a big deal. The milk was sour, the eggs were cracked, the toast was burnt, but it's not a big deal. We're a team. That's nice. You do it one day, you do it 2 days. But then when you have to deal with it day after day, and I gave small examples, there are big examples. Like what's a big example?
The fire is great. The woman who started fire.
True story. That's a true story. But you have one car and you both need it and you share it very well, but she's not as good a driver as you are. And every time you tell her, when you go reverse, you got to look back. It's dangerous. You could kill someone. You got to look back. And she says, yeah, I'll get into the habit. But by the time she gets into the habit, the car's a wreck and you're lucky she didn't kill anyone. So you look at it and you say, yeah, that's a part of me. No, it isn't. I always look back. Is that a
part? How started this evening, right? You became Avram, so it was
she never was through this together, right?
It's hope. That's what I'm saying. Because he didn't start with the world embracing him.
Right? He asked, why doesn't it come naturally? I'm saying, because naturally you walk into marriage and you see the other person's weaknesses and you say, I don't do that. You sit at an event and she makes the stupid comment that everyone turns red and you turn even redder. They serve soup and it tastes a little salty. And she's the one that goes, oh, whoa. And you're thinking, why'd you have to say that? So now, yeah, you're going to look at that and say, right, that's my other half. No, you're going to want to do this.
I said in his last place, if we don't marry Russell and we get laid, we got a little way to do.
Where you're asking why it doesn't happen naturally, because you don't realize what your weaknesses and what her weaknesses are, and then you walk into marriage and it's not so easy to fight for her honor.
So you fake it until you make it. How does that work?
Spend a decade faking it and then become second nature.
Right, just snowballs though. Isn't that true?
Wait, I wasn't joking. I was serious.
Are you married a decade?
More than a decade.
So just as equally as you're faking it, she's having to fake it as well, though, right?
See, that's one of the shortcomings of this class, that the audience is all male.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about women. It would be a totally different class for women. You see, men have this weakness that they do this. When men have it, it's much more in the male psyche to distance himself from the woman. It's much easier in the male psyche. Women have a different challenge. It's not this. No. She doesn't have to fake it for 10 years. She has other problems. I mean, she has other problems with her husband.
Yeah.
And she also sees his weaknesses. But it's on a totally different plane. No, it's not the same.
Is it important for us to know what plane that she sees our weaknesses so that we could, like, combat our own weaknesses and curb them to not be weaknesses anymore?
I'll only tell you one thing. For every time you have to swallow something she does, she's already swallowed 10 of yours. Okay, that's the ratio. Okay? Because as much as a guy thinks he's great, and all guys think they're great, and as much as a guy thinks she's so lucky she married me and I'm such a nice guy, I'm putting up with her, if we would really put things down on a playing field, see, the issue is they don't tell us. Meaning women are, like the Gemara says, tovat balev. A woman's nature is that she isn't as expressive about what bothers her and what she would like. And so there's going to be many things that you're doing, trampling all over her feelings, and you don't even know you did it. And when it comes time to put down the scorecard and you decide you're going to tell her a piece of your mind, you know those three things that really ticked you off. But you don't know the 30 things you did that ticked her off. And even when she'll finally tell you one, you won't understand what she's talking about. So that's why it's a little challenging.
So were females just created with more patience and midot keilu?
I think that deserves another class. That would be an oversimplification to say more patience. I worded it differently. Chazal say, Tovat balev. It doesn't say they're not toveya. It doesn't say women don't have their demands. It says women's demands are in their heart. That's different. It didn't say they forgo their demands. No, we say it. I don't think you could say one is better than the other. In a male world, in a male classroom, everyone will say, yeah, that's better. Sure, that's better. I want a beer. I say, I want a beer. You know how it works, right? Honey, what do you want to do tonight? So she says, what do you want? And you tell her, finished. Right? So is that better? I don't know. And then she says, at the end of the night, Nu, did you have a good time? And you look at her and say, you didn't? And she'll say, but we did what you wanted. Did you have a good time? And now you feel like 2 cents. And you say, wait a second. I began by offering you. What do you want? And she says, no, and I offered you too. And you say, right, so I took you up on it. And you feel very good about it, right? Because that's the male way of doing things. Is that better? I don't know if that's better.
How are they supposed to know, though? I never got that with women. Why do they sumaino what they want to do?
What?
Why do they sumaino what they want to do on a certain night?
Ah, so you guys are taking me down a whole different path. That's not our Mishnah. You're asking, how do you understand what does she want in her heart? If Chazal say a woman is tovat balev, so okay, we'll go off on this tangent for 2 minutes. So let's analyze what happened here. A man is toveya bapeh. He bluntly and blatantly expresses what he wants. And a woman is toveya balev. She desires in her heart. So now that we know that piece of information, so then we didn't say that, what we might have said, that she's willing to forgo more easily. We didn't say that. It might be true. It could be that she's more patient, but that's not what we're discussing. We're saying that she won't be as openly expressive of what she wants. That's different than saying she forgoes what she wants.
Are those not communication issues?
No. You see, you're viewing it through male lens. Right? If in male language, when we want something, we say it and she's not talking the male language, then she has a communication issue. But if in a female world, two females are getting together and one speaks to the other and they can both get to what the other one wants, then it's not a communication issue. At least not her communication issue. It's our communication issue. I'll tell you a little secret. It's your communication issue. Because if it's her problem, it's going to be your problem. It's, that means if I know that she wants something, but she's not telling me, so what am I supposed to do? So there are two ways of approaching this. There's the classical male approach, which says, could you stop being a woman and tell me what you want? Okay, that's again, straight male. I am male, work my system, talk to me the way I know how to talk, and I want to fit your circle into my square. Come on, just do it my way, right? Why can't you just communicate? Come on. In other words, why can't you do things my way? But she's female. She's entitled to be female. So what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to say, you know, I'm not sure what I want yet. What would you want to do tonight? Right? So right, you said it the first time, but we said she wants it in her heart. That means she's not going to openly say it. Meaning she's going to be more sensitive not to encroach your space. And so she's not going to openly say the first time, I really would have liked to go for a walk tonight. You're going to say, well, the Mets game is on. You know, I've been waiting to see the Mets game. I was waiting for this. This is a great idea. Thanks for asking. And if you want to make popcorn, I'm going to really enjoy it. And you finish the Mets game and you look at her and say, wasn't that a great game? And she's not enthused, right?
But is it more difficult for them to adapt to our language for communication?
Like, what do you mean your language and their language?
Sometimes they say things and I don't get it.
That's amazing. If it's only sometimes you're ahead of the game, okay.
I said this a minute ago, like, it does want to do things our way. We want to do things their way. They just don't tell us what their way is.
Oh, so you have to learn to talk their language.
What do you mean their language and your language? I'm saying, isn't there just one language?
No, not at all.
So you're both speaking English.
Let's take a small example, okay? You go to the store and she tries on a dress, a blouse, or whatever. I don't know the difference anymore. I never knew the difference. Okay, she tries on a garment and and she asks you, is it too tight? And you say, yeah, it's a little tight. And she looks at you and she's turning colors. And you ask, what happened? And she says, you told me I'm the fattest woman in the store. Don't you have any shame? And you're looking at her and you say, I didn't say you were fat. You said, and she says, oh, you called me an elephant. And you say, no, I think you're perfect. Your nose is perfect, just right. The difference between me and an elephant is my nose. Now you said it. No, I didn't. I didn't say that. That's not what I said. Yes, you did. Ah, so you didn't, wait. Okay, so now how do you communicate? So let's take a step back. If she has something she wants, but she's not expressing it, so then what she wants is for me to know what she wants.
And that's not being petty. I'm saying when I'm dealing with like a little kid, that's how they act. I don't know if I'm being too direct, but do you get what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying.
Okay.
But you don't get what I'm saying, so I'm just trying to think how to get the point across. Let me think for a minute. Let's take two men, okay? Two friends are going to meet for the first time in 3-4 years, right? So let's imagine that one of them is very considerate of the other one, okay? So let's say our conversation is taking place, you know, let's say Netanyahu calls up an old buddy from his army days, and he says, why don't we catch up? We haven't spoken in years. What do you say we go out for a drink? So the buddy wants to be considerate. You know, Netanyahu's whole entourage and everyone. So he tells him, well, what time works for you and where would you want to meet? And Netanyahu says, the conversation begins the other way. Netanyahu says to the guy, when would you want to meet? What time works for you? I'll be happy for us to catch up. And the other guy says to Netanyahu, he says, look, I know you have the whole entourage. I know you're busy. And I'd love to get to catch up on old times. So you tell me what works for you. At this point in the conversation, would you say that Netanyahu should just come back and tell him exactly what works for him? And then the guy should fit his schedule? 100%. Wait. What would be if Netanyahu would say, look, obviously I have time constraints, but let's see when could work for you. Or let's take a simpler example. If you had, if you wanted to go for a job interview, and you had to fly in for the job interview, and obviously you want the job interview, so you call and ask them, you call and they're interested, they've replied to your resume, they ask you when could you come in? And you come back and say, look, I'll make whatever works for you work for me. So they'd be legitimate telling you what works for them, but you'd agree with me that if they said, why don't you check your flight schedule, see when works for you, you don't want to have to fly in at 3 o'clock in the morning and come in all wiped, you'd agree with me that then you'd feel they were nicer people to work with, right? So if we can frame the conversation with a woman the following, and you guys are taking me to 5 different classes, each one is its own class, but okay, put them all together a little bit here, but really each one needs to be developed. If we can remember that in conversation, a woman is always thinking, does he love me? And whatever you're saying is being gauged with that perspective. Men are the same, only they're not thinking, does he love me? They're thinking, does he respect me? That's what every man is thinking. Take every sentence a guy says and put beforehand the sentence, does everyone think I'm great because I'm going to say this? Or does my wife think I'm great because I'm going to say this? We each have that introductory sentence to everything we say. So if her introductory sentence is going to be, does he love me? And then she says, I'll do whatever you want. Now you answer, okay, I want to watch the Mets game tonight. What did she just hear? He's not thinking about me. I'm not so important to him. He wants to watch the Met game tonight. Of course she offered you. But if you really loved her, if you were really considerate, you'd come back and say, look, I don't want to just do what I want. I want to understand what you want. So she was considerate, but that doesn't mean she doesn't have desires. You call the guy in the employment office, or you call the guy's calling Netanyahu. Of course he's going to say, tell me what works for you. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't expect, if the other side really cared for me, they'd come back and say, okay, and what do you want? So this is a part of the picture. Meaning, as we learn, we'll see other parts of the picture. So coming back to here. So we went off on a long tangent.
We learned a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we said, number one is not to have jealousy. And our friend's honor is as important as our own honor. And I think this is like a fundamental point in marriage. Meaning there are a lot of things we can try to build. But I think one of the most basic points is mutual respect. So we don't get along. So we're upset at one another. Yes, marriage involves fights. Every marriage has their fights. Sometimes it's every 2 minutes. Sometimes it's every 2 hours. Sometimes it's every 2 days. It's rare that it's less than that. You're going to have explosions, two people living together. The nature of things is that things are going to be rough. You have ups and downs and ups and downs, and that's life. can you maintain mutual respect? And that's a challenge. It's a challenge. You discover in marriage emotions you never knew you had. So, number one, Ayin Tova, part of having a good eye, being a disciple of Avraham Avinu, is, my friend's honors, as beloved to me as my own. That's a very high level. And the other issue Rashi alludes to here is not to be jealous. And you'd be surprised how often we're jealous. Now, if we look at Avram as opposed to Bilam, there's a fascinating thing here. Avram is married to Sarah and they want children and Sarah can't have kids. And Avram doesn't take a second wife. They're married for decades. And he has a lineage, he has a whole a theory to pass on, monotheism. Who's he going to pass it on to? It's very important to him. But he doesn't have who to pass it on to until Sarah comes along and says, take Hagar. And even then, he doesn't become attached to Hagar. He does what his wife says. Proof of it is when God tells him to send away Hagar and Yishmael, the Pasuk right away tells us that Avram was very pained over Yishmael. The Pasuk says, doesn't say he was pained over Hagar, because he never tried to develop anything with Hagar. His wife told him, bring a child to the world with Hagar. He listened to her, but he wasn't developing anything with her. He was completely loyal to his wife. Bilam, on the other hand, never gets married. He sleeps every night with his donkey. So he's only into the physical pleasure he can get out of a relationship. There's no point in creating anything. Now, if we want to be kind, if we want to have a good eye, so then we have, the question is, where do we look? There's the famous story of Rav Moshe Leiv of Sasov. You guys know the story. He came to a city where no one knew him. Yeah, and he went into a store, and the guy, the storekeeper, sees, we'll call him Rav Yaakov, he sees a new Jew in town. He doesn't know him. He says, friend, you're new here. Maybe you need a place to rest. Maybe you need something to eat. He takes him into his house. He doesn't know who he is. And he offers him to eat and he offers him to drink and he offers him a bed. Now this guy, Rav Yaakov, is a very poor storekeeper. He has very few customers. But he takes care of Rav Moshe Leib as though he was the most cherished guest. And Rav Moshe Leib sees that the guy is very poor. And yet, he's always taking in guests. Even while he's there, he sees there are other guests being brought in. He offers people a drink. From the little bit he has, he makes everyone feel at home. So when he gets up to leave, he blesses Rav Yaakov. He says, look, I see you're really nice and you've taken care of me and you take care of other people. I bless you that God should bless you with wealth so that you could take care of others. And he leaves. And later, Rav Yaakov hears it was his Rebbe, Rav Moshe Leiv of Sasov, who was there. And sure enough, he becomes super wealthy. His store starts bustling with people and he's selling and he sells his old house, he buys a new house. Slowly but surely he develops a mansion and he stops taking in guests. He has all this wealth, he doesn't have time for guests. So now he's this wealthy businessman and Rav Moshe Leiv comes visiting through town. He goes looking for Rav Yaakov's store, and it's no longer there. There's this big business. He asks people, where is he? They tell him, oh, he became a big businessman. He goes over to the guy's house, and there are guards at the door, and they won't let him in. And he says, I need to talk to Rav Yaakov. And they say, look, we don't know who you are, but he doesn't take people in. If you're not here with an invitation, you can't come in. So he says, tell him that Moshe Leiv of Sasov came to see him. So with that, he walks away. They send word to Rav Yaakov. He comes running out. He runs after the Rebbe. He calls him in. He brings him into his house. He says, can I bring you a drink? Can I bring you something to eat? And he says, no. He looks at his window. He looks out the window. He looks at Rav Yaakov. And he looks around the room. He sees all the affluence, all the wealth. And he sees a beautiful gold mirror on the wall, gold frame mirror. So he walks over to the mirror, takes it off the wall, and he says to him, Yaakov, come here. Yaakov's standing there, he was the Rebbe one. He says, look at the window. What do you see? He says, I see outside, I see a lot of people. He says, look at this glass, what do you see? So he says, I see myself. So he says, why is it when you look through that glass, you see other people, and when you look at this glass, you only see yourself? So he says, well, the glass has a silver coating behind it that causes a reflection. That's a mirror. So when there's a silver coating behind it, you see yourself. And when you look out clear glass, you see what's outside. You see the other people. So the Rebbe tells him, he says, right. Before you had all the silver, you were able to see other people. Now that you have all the silver, you're not seeing other people. So if that's what you need, then we can give you a blessing that you will peel off the silver and you'll be able to see other people again. And Yaakov gets the hint and he says, no, I understand. And in the center of his house, from that day on, he had that mirror with a little piece of the silver peeled off to remind him what his job is. Now, we're all that way. If our focus is the nefesh rechava, that's what Bilam is. He's looking after the money, so then it's hard to look at other people positively. Because if it's a dog-eat-dog world, and we're all in the race, and our focus is getting to that silver, so then everyone else is a means to that end. It's very hard to see other people, because I'm focused on that. Bilam, who is focused on money and honor and taking care of himself at the expense of others, he's willing to curse God's chosen people just to make more money. Look at Avram. Avram wants to help everyone, even the Sodomites. God puts him up to a test. He's telling him, I'm going to kill the Sodomites. Avram should have said, great, be gone with them. No. He's connected to all of humanity. Even when the Sodomites are getting destroyed, he's coming up and saying, God, wait, maybe we can save him somehow. So the three traits go hand in hand. And within a marriage, they also go hand in hand. When a person is focused on his own honor, so then even his wife becomes a pawn in attaining his own honor. When a person can be focused on being kind to others, so then everything else becomes supportive of that. And that's when a person can start connecting. I think that one line that really sums it up is, am I out working for the house so that my wife can bring up the kids? Or is my wife taking care of the kids so I can go out to work? Many people unwittingly will tell you, she's taking care of the kids so I can go out to work. It's a partnership. No. She's doing the important role. She's taking care of the kids. You're going out to work. You're serving her to facilitate that. The key is the home. And the key is your relationship with your wife. Very often people are put at odds where they have to decide in conversation or in different circumstances where is my stress? Where do my loyalties lie? And if a person maintains a focus, we're partners, this is the most important thing, then everything else can fall by the wayside. What were the three traits we just learned about? Ayin tova, a good eye. He desires good for others. Ruach nemucha, humility. And nefesh shefela, a person who can be happy with his lot. He isn't always focused on getting more. And gentlemen, this is probably the greatest challenge we have today. Because we live in a world where you can really make a lot of money. You can really get many amenities. You never had a world with as many amenities as today. There's no limit to how far you can go. And so we really have to take care to maintain focus, because otherwise there's never time to be home. How could I have time to be with my family? I could make more money. How could I have time to be with my kids? I could be making more money. If the focus isn't the home, if a person doesn't have that nefesh shefela, if a person can't be content with what he has, so then he'll always be taking on more, taking a few more hours, and making more money. But what's he making all the money for? So he has a better car. Great. But where's life? And life keeps going. Life doesn't wait for us. People very often miss the most beautiful years of their life. I had the pleasure of deleting SMSs. No, my SMS box was full. And I came across an SMS where my wife wrote to me, guess who learned how to climb out of the crib? And I was thinking back to that milestone. You know, today it's a given. We don't even put him in the crib anymore. But a year ago, or three quarters of a year ago, it was like a big deal. He climbed out of the crib. Now, if the home is the focus, so that's great. If your focus is everything else and making money, so who cares? I feel bad. She's going to have to deal with a kid who knows how to climb out of the crib. Okay, good luck putting him to bed. But that's it. Move forward with life. We have a choice, and in our day and age, it becomes a harder choice. The Talmud says, and we rule like this in Halacha, that the age of mourning for one who loses a child shifts in direct proportion with his wealth. The wealthier a person is, the less he's going to have time to be focused on his relationship with his kids. And so if he, God forbid, loses a younger child, it won't mean as much to him. His age of mourning for a child is an older age, because he only connects at an older age. Who has time to connect to the two-year-old? It's a proportion. So it's a choice we make. It's a choice of focus. The Mishnah puts three traits together. It tells us a good eye. That's an eye that seeks the good of others. Humility and a minimalistic approach. I don't have to have everything in life. So then I can talk to people. I can talk to the next guy. I don't have to be bigger or better than the next guy. That connection. And the Mishnah concludes and tells us, and this is what Mr. Fleisch was pointing out, what does it mean, l'anchil ohava yesh? So I thought the word yesh shouldn't be taken literally. I didn't think the word yesh should be taken as a physical blessing. I thought the word yesh has so much meaning. David is called the son of Yishai. The word yesh means an existence. The yeshut, we say, about actual existence. One of the things we aspire for in life is a continuous existence. Everyone wants it. You know, they say that's why Sharon suddenly got obsessed with the idea of kicking people out of Gush Katif. They say many leaders reach a point where their legacy becomes their focus. They suddenly want to have a legacy. They should leave something behind in the world. So that's a tremendous desire that many people have. To leave behind something. Let me leave a legacy. And that yesh, that I think is the stress of the pasuk. Those that love me, the Torah says, will leave a real imprint on the world. A yesh, an existence in the world. And that's what a person wants to do with his family, with his investment of time and assets. And the flip side is with Bilam. So, okay, in summation, we spoke about three traits. A good eye, not being jealous, seeking out the other's honor. We spoke about humility, and we spoke about being content with what we have. The three come into play in marriage big time. A good eye is something to work on. It doesn't come naturally. Naturally, people are jealous of one another. In a marriage, too, there's going to be competition, and a person has to work to undo that trait. That goes hand in hand with humility. If I don't have to take all the credit and I don't have to be the greatest, Rabbi Dr. Twersky has a beautiful line. He says, if you win an argument, that's not always good, because you don't want to have married a loser. So if she wins the argument, so then you married a winner. That's also good. Alevi, you should worry about her having married a loser. And the idea of being content with what we have, so that's an idea that's really going to define our lives. It's going to define what hours you work. It's going to define where you invest your strength in life. At the end of the day, everyone needs to put bread on the table. But we work for so much more, and we take it for granted that we have to have so much more. And that's probably the biggest challenge of our generation, because there's no end to how far we can get today. And that's a challenge we have to decide on. You know, if I told you you could live in a caravan, you'd think I was crazy. I was telling someone, yeah, you think about it for 5 years. Do you think about it for 20 years?
I lived in a caravan.
Do you think about raising kids in a caravan? I'm saying our perspectives have changed. If we don't have the amenities we're accustomed to, we think we're the most miserable person on the planet. I lived for 2 weeks without running water. When we moved to Kochav Yaakov, we came into the apartment, there wasn't running water. No bath, no shower, no sink. We were lucky that after a short period of time, one toilet worked. That was great. No showers still. So you look at that and you say, how can you live that way? You can live that way. All our grandparents lived that way. Our great-grandparents, the whole world lived that way. Up until 100 years ago or 70 years ago. It's not the end of the world. We have a beautiful life today. But that's not good enough for us.
You mentioned there was a president that I thought meaningful in the last class, because in the best of America, it's just not done. You thought long and hard when you moved to Gatkoa, because the kids were used to sleeping two to a bed. And
right.
It was like giving them overindulging in Gashmias by doing that. That's a statement you don't here generally today. You know,
right, but you
and
know.
They certainly probably had no problem.
They had no problem. Deprived. The kids never thought that they were deprived.
Yeah.
We had until this year.
The bars changes and people think they're doing it for the kids, but as we know, the work, you're comfortable, you're away, you rationalize that you're doing it for family, fool yourself.
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, the kids are fine with it.
But that works if you can be happy with it. Meaning you and your wife.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Meaning if you look at it and say to yourself, I'm the most miserable person on earth. My kids are having the most miserable childhood because they're sleeping two to a bed. You know, when the kids came to me once and said, Abba, why can't we each have our own bed? So I answered them. I said, when you can stay only two in a bed, then you could talk to me about having one in a bed. Being that on an average night you end up four in a bed. So don't talk to me about one in a bed. They would all end up moving in the night and end up on one bed, all of them. I took pictures of it because you wouldn't believe it until you saw it, right? They move in their sleep. So I said, what are you asking for? One, you know, well, so what? So you could end up climbing all four into one bed afterwards? You know, what'd you gain? What? No, but we had pull-out. We still have pull-out beds. Top bed, second bed, and third bed. And they'd all matriculate up or down. It didn't, you know, somehow they'd all end up on one bed. What?
And how do you matriculate up?
I don't know. You'd have to watch them in their sleep. I guess I don't know. Okay, I'm saying, but that only works if your perspective is that way. If you're living in a house where your kids are two to bed and you think you're miserable and it's the worst life, so then that's what your kids will think. If you're happy with it, they can be happy with it. I'm not saying you can always live in a cramped quarters. I'm saying there's what to think about. Kids do need a certain amount of space. You have to think about that too. Each scenario has to be analyzed. But I'm saying in our generation, we take tremendous amenities for granted, and we think that the minimum is way higher than it has to be. Now, that's one of the good things of coming out of Machon Meir dorms. Right? 7-8 people to a room, right? No air, no air conditioning, no heating, you know. One closet. Huh?
Forget the crazy people out there.
What?
You had mentioned that you should look at your friend's honor as your own. But I come across many people in my life that are nice. How do you know when to invest in a friendship? And when, I have a lot of nice people that I see in my life, but do I have to keep all these people's honor as my own? Or is it just who you consider your close friends? You know what I mean? There's nice people, yeah, I'm friendly with them, but how do you make the selection there? You know what I mean? Because I remember once you said you have to invest in a friendship. So, is it only the people you're investing in, or how do you make the choice there?
I'm just debating which story to tell, because there are a lot of stories that illustrate the point, but maybe we'll forgo the stories because we're short on time. But in a nutshell, respecting someone doesn't have to mean I'm developing a friendship with them. We encounter a lot of people in our lifetime, and obviously we won't be able to be friends with all of them. But I can be respectful of all of them. I once spoke to a guy who was learning in a yeshiva, and I asked him, how many friends do you have in your yeshiva? He said, one. I said, how many guys do you have in your class? He said, 20. I said, then how come you have only one friend? He said, because everyone calls me a nickname and they never ask me permission to call me that nickname. I don't like that nickname. And they all smile. And I'd like to think they mean well. But there's one guy who doesn't call me the nickname. That's my friend. I'm nice with all of them. But there's one friend. Now, that's sad. Because if we would really be respectful of the other person, if I could, if his honor were cherished by me, then I would be careful how I speak to him. And these are scenarios we encounter on a daily basis. We had a guard who would always stamp our receipts as we left the store, right? So he was the guard of the grocery store, and the kids would always ask him to stamp their hands. So one time they asked him what his name is. So he says his name is Ovadia. So the kids say, Ovadia, could you stamp my hand? So I said to the kids, he has a last name. And they said, but he said his name's Ovadia. And I said, but he's old enough to be your father. You're not going to call him by his first name. You're going to call him Mr. Eliassi. So the guard says, no, everyone calls me Ovadia. I said, yeah, everyone but my kids. To my kids, you're Mr. Eliassi. One time he confided in me. He said, you know, they're the only ones that respect me. No one calls me Mr. anything because I'm just the guard. I wasn't about to point out to him, you know, you introduce yourself by your first name. You argue, you should be called by your first name. But that, you know, there's something to be said about that. The question is it important to me? Is his honor important to me? Our nature is that it's not important at all. We don't care. And that's a good situation. The more common situation is that we're very happy to call him Ovadia and I'm Mr. So-and-so. The Mishnah teaches us a trait to develop. And we were applying it within the home. Where the halacha says if you have a limited budget, Yom Tov's coming up, and you need a new suit as much as your wife needs a new suit, the halacha demands you buy her. She comes first. So her honor is supposed to be more important than my honor. And that's a perspective the halacha wants from me. And now, obviously, the question is, how is it going to play itself out in the home, in the running of the home, when people come and talk to us? And it could be simple things, like they'll ask you questions, and does your wife know this? Or what do you guys do with your kids when they talk back to you? What do you do? What does your wife do? You will have an opinion on your wife's parenting skills. You'll have issues you agree with her. You'll have issues you don't agree with her. Okay, but if her honor is important, then the way you answer will not reveal that. This comes up over and over again. And again, this is, you have to begin by faking it. Give yourself a few years of faking it, and with time you'll start to mean it. But you have to fake it initially, because our nature, this doesn't happen initially. Initially, the competition is overwhelming. You'd like to think it happens naturally, but it doesn't. It takes time. And the truth is, it's connected with the good eye. If I can look positively at the other person, then I can start to appreciate the other person. But the question is me, not them. We will always have the excuse. Of course I don't look positively at her. My neighbor, look at how his wife talks to the kids. Look at how his wife cleans the house. We can always find reasons why it's her fault, why I don't see her positively. Always. The Mishnah says, no, it's a question of what my eye is. I need to develop an Ein Tova. And that's hard. That's hard. Now, we just touched on this point, but you should know this is always the case. You get married, and every guy can tell you why, what's wrong with his wife. And it's true. But the question is, what am I looking at? And it's a question of my perspective, because every wife is going to have certain issues. And we have issues too. But that's not our subject tonight. Okay. Beseder. So, to be continued.